Apparently was Angelina, not quite sure where from, but it was on the Winamp, so we played it. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Coming up for 2 hours, it's the Bathrob Spears Broadside Show. I'm Bathrob Spear. I mean, you could see my broadsides if you were here, but you're just going to have to be content with taking my word for it. Your voice can come on the air with whatever broadsides you wish to put out. I particularly focus on civil rights for poor people. I'm going to be talking today and playing some tape from the city council's latest fiasco, the banning of all new medical marijuana dispensaries inside the city limits and the giving of a monopoly, or perhaps we call it a duopoly, to the two existing clubs, the Greenway and Lime Kiln clubs. I'll be playing some stuff from that. And I had intended to have on the air Doug Loisel, former Homeless Service Center director, with his plan to house another 100 homeless folks that he had presented about 6 or 8 months ago to the Homeless Service Center. Apparently gotten a good reception from the Board of Directors, but the City Council, perhaps as usual, stalled it to death, or at least has done nothing about it since his presentation. Loisel is no longer head of the Homeless Service Center, having been forced into retirement by charges, and I guess he did a plea bargain down south in terms of a sting operation where an FBI agent posing as an underage girl invited him to a hotel, and he came there, and he's doing some community service for that now. But aside from that, and actually that's kind of irrelevant to his behavior up here, which has been pretty much without much criticism. I've criticized some of his decisions, mostly notice that he opened up 24-hour bathrooms, the only 24-hour bathrooms in Santa Cruz, unless you happen to be a customer to an all-night restaurant or a gas station, at the Homeless Service Center. He's the one who restored the right to come into the Homeless Service Center during the day. He also pressed for a number of other reforms, and he was going to be on the air tonight, but he has postponed, and who knows when he's going to be doing that. He's having some concerns about the Santa Cruz media up here. And I can appreciate his concern, although I think you got to be rough and tough in these matters and stand up and speak about the issues, even if they shoot at you and shit on you and so forth, because that's what some media does. That's just how it is. I'm rather outspoken in how I regard some council members. Of course, that doesn't stop them from doing their thing. So there's also been a day of the Coastal Commission's examination of a number of issues, specifically the Arena Gulch issue, the question of a Broadway Brommer bike emergency vehicle bridge pathway, which has been hotly debated and contested for at least a decade. And I had a couple of folks I was hoping would be able to call in or come in and talk about this issue. We'll see if that happens. They have other commitments, and they're also maybe tired from all the walking tours that happened. Apparently the Coastal Commission trotted around town checking out the various sites, and the community may have gone with them. After all, it's a public activity. So let me begin then with the medical marijuana issue, or actually the issue of prohibition of medical marijuana sales at a dispensary, which is what the City Council unanimously voted for. Again, they've done it 3 times before in the last year, and their planning commission has done the same, voting essentially to freeze out any new medical marijuana dispensaries that might want to open in Santa Cruz, and, as I said, maintain a monopoly to the existing two, Greenway and Lime Kiln. If you want to see my my own take on this in greater detail and not have to listen to me talk about it, you can go to the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, and there's a whole story. Santa Cruz City Council votes to ban additional medical marijuana dispensaries, and I've written a bit about it there. Bradley has done a great job of capturing pictures of the Tuesday fiasco. You can find that on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website. Again, IndieBay, IndyBay, IndieBay.org/Santa Cruz. And it's just look for Santa Cruz Indie Media, Google for it, and it's interesting stuff. there is a second vote coming up in 2 weeks, so theoretically it could be defeated. I've suggested a referendum. A referendum drive might be one way for this to proceed. People can try to get essentially 6,000 registered voters to sign a petition, which they get from the city, which requires the city council to hold, to hold an election on the issue, which could overturn it. So, dialogue on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, and now we're going to hear a little bit of the Santa Cruz City Council meeting, which may also be replayed on community TV for those of you who have cable TV, although I don't know that many poor people do. So here it is. Here is at least some of what was said, and I'm going to play more of it, I believe, on Sunday, depending on how folks respond to this. Call a number in case you want to call in, and we will take calls, even in the midst of this tape, because I'm going to interrupt it, too, whenever I get cranky enough, is 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. 427-3772 is the call-in number here. And feel free to call in if you're outside the area. It's 831-427-3772. If you want to reach me off-air, it's 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. Let's jump into the City Council meeting of Tuesday, item 17, the banning of the medical marijuana dispensaries. I think there were two applications, one of which, one guy just went away shaking his head sadly. The other guy, I think his name is Stuart Krieg, kept trying, but he got slapped down for his trouble. They did refund him his fees, but of course, the amount of money he is spending, I guess, to hold, I would imagine, to hold a piece of property as rental space is probably costing him an arm and a leg, though I haven't talked to him and he hasn't talked to me, so I don't know. Anyway, here's some of the beginning of the item. We're going to start at the beginning and plod through and see where we get to.
Seventeen out of order. I think most people are probably here for the medical marijuana dispensary issue. I'm sure we'll have time to get to the other items on our agenda. But
and that's Mayor Mike Rotkin, who is the presiding officer at City Council. You know, the great
I'm sure we'll have time to get to the other items on our agenda, but I think I'll move this up unless there's disagreement.
Could do 16.
So we're now on item number 17. I know, but there's a large audience. I thought I'd try and respect their time. Medical marijuana dispensaries, personal medical marijuana use ordinances, and introduce Mike Ferry from the Planning Department.
And before we get into this tiresome presentation, the illusion that he's respecting the audience.
Introduce Mike Ferry from the Planning Department.
Is something that Mike Rotkin is frequently makes a show of. However, he has approved the new agenda, which states that 2 minutes per speaker is now the normal time on public hearings, which had been 3 minutes and 5 minutes for organizations. And he has similarly generally proceeded with the cutback oral communications time, as well as shortening dramatically all discussion of consent agenda items and administrative agenda items. So his respect for the public is quite subordinated to his deference to the staff.
And introduce Mike Ferry from the Planning Department, Planning and Community Development Department, who will help present a staff report here.
Just a second.
He wasn't ready. I sprung it on him, so he doesn't have his thing loaded up yet. Can I see a show of hands, the number of people who are going to want to testify on this matter? Please raise your hands. So we're going to allow people to have 2 minutes each when the time comes. But first we're going to hear the staff report of what's being proposed, and then I'll take public input before the council does that.
And it should be understood, this is an afternoon hearing. There is no meeting in the evening, which, of course, was the standard practice in Santa Cruz until Mayors Matthews, Coonerty, and Rotkin became established a new norm of essentially rushing things through in the afternoon at a time when many people can't attend. And also then using the fact that they've compressed these meetings into the afternoon to as a further excuse for cutting back public comment time. Instead of giving everybody 2 minutes, he obviously needs to give people a longer period of time and lengthen the hearing. It's a serious matter, and it's an issue that goes against the grain of progressive Santa Cruz to say, here's the town that, you know, in 1992 voted to, was one of the first communities, if not the first community, to vote for countywide to have medical marijuana legalized in its area. I mean, it didn't become a state proposition until 1996 when 215 was passed. But now, 18 or 19 years later, we have the great liberal city council banning all applications for medical marijuana dispensaries, even though you'll hear in some of the testimony, I believe, but certainly I've heard in a number of websites and talked to a number of people who said that it's completely inadequate in Santa Cruz, and there's no good reason to limit medical marijuana dispensaries. Even more, not to declare it an emergency, as this council did in June and July, in order to freeze two applications that were coming in and not even allow them the respect of a hearing, shows a very strong, it's actually a very weak kind of, I think, surrender to prohibitionist forces in the Santa Cruz community, masquerading under labels. Oh, we favor legalization of marijuana, but we don't want another medical marijuana dispensary in our town. Why? You don't get a clear answer. Well, that we have enough because the other towns are limiting it, so we should do the same. You know, it's like other towns don't want blacks, so we don't want them either. You know, other towns criminalize the homeless, so we'll do the same. It's bad reasoning. This is Mike Ferry, Planning Commission Director, Planning Department Director, or before the public worker in that department.
Yeah, I wanted to. Mike?
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Council members.
I want an opportunity to push this off so we can have it in the evening session.
In 2000, the City Council adopted the medical marijuana ordinance that regulated dispensaries and production houses within the city, and they also approved the personal medical marijuana use that's in Chapter 6.9 of the Muni Code. Between 2000 and 2009, the city processed two special use permits to open dispensaries. Both of those are operating, and they've been operating without problems in the Harvey West area. In February of 2009, the federal government announced that they would end the marijuana raids in states that had medical marijuana rules on the books. And I think annually from when we first approved our ordinance to that point in time, maybe we got between 5 and 10 calls a year requesting information about opening dispensaries. After the federal announcement that they wouldn't come into the states with rules and regulations on medical marijuana, we started to get 20 and 30 phone calls a week. I think we got between 50 and 80 phone calls in the next 2 months in terms of questions on how to operate or open a dispensary and grow houses. Two of those inquiries ended up with applications being submitted in May. There was two other parties that were trying to find a location and had all of their ducks lined up, but the council approved a moratorium in June. The moratorium was extended for 6 months in July and an additional 4 months last January.
And all this was done as an emergency measure, an extreme emergency measure for the health and safety and welfare of the community, with absolutely no finding made as to why this was the case. In any of those three city council extensions, and as far as I can tell, in any of the planning commission hearings that were held in November, although I guess they weren't considering that issue, but rather these noxious rules that they are now going to be voting on, essentially the ban on medical marijuana dispensaries' new applications. Also, this sudden claim, the claim that there's this sudden concern about a rash of medical marijuana dispensaries opening up, the 2000 ordinance is very strict in its limitations and gives people in the community who don't want these places opened a lot of leeway and a lot of dirt they can throw in the process. And there were actually only two applications that were actually completed and presented to the planning department. So this claim of a frenzied number coming their way, first of all, that doesn't constitute an emergency anyway. But secondly, it doesn't seem to be backed up by much that's solid. Though I will say this for Mr. Ferry, that this is the first time he's actually given the specific statistics on the numbers of calls he received. Instead, he would say many, many, and the council would scurry like rats to do what the planning department wanted them to do.
Moratorium. One of the applicants that came in May withdrew his application, and the second applicant that's on Ingle Street lost the lease of the from the property owner, and that site's been leased to a new commercial user. The framework that we were working under when we developed these ordinance amendments included the fact that the city is the only agency within the county that has medical marijuana laws on the books. It's been 10 years since we first had those ordinance approved, and the legal environment has changed dramatically since 2000, in terms of the federal government mostly.
And this is another question. I mean, just as though some people believe that President Obama is going to lead us to the land of milk and honey overseas in terms of ending the wars, and we instead have seen them, one of them ramped up, the other slightly ramped down, but security personnel, I understand, are still a huge presence with huge bases in Iraq and so forth. So similarly with the marijuana regulation, there were statements made by the Attorney General, but there have also been busts of marijuana clubs still happening. It is true that in San Jose some clubs have begun to open up. In Capitola and Boulder Creek, there have been, you know, people who wanted to open up dispensaries. And this kind of goes against the argument that Mike Ferry is claiming that there's, you know, Santa Cruz is in this unique position. It's true, it's the only one that's passed ordinances, restrictive ordinances. But in other places, I guess in the county, where there is no ordinance, it's... I don't know if it's open season or whether you're just risking your life or risking your fortune to try to open a club. I know that the district attorney went after Roger Mensch in the Hemporium with a hatchet and an elephant gun, and he's still being taken to court, or was when I ran into him a couple months ago, although that's now happening in Santa Clara County. I think the authorities over here are cooperating in that effort. This is a prohibitionist mentality at the police level, at the DA level, at the city council level, and at the planning department level. And it's being masked by language that makes it appear to be, oh, we're simply trying to regulate. Well, banning new dispensaries is not regulating, particularly when there's no Office of Compassionate Use, as was passed by the city council in 2005, that should be providing for free marijuana for those who need it, or marijuana at a reasonable price.
The closest legal facility that was existing was in the city of Oakland, and I believe that's still the case.
No, it's not still the case, and I'm surprised that no one on the city council, well, we'll have to see if he's called on that, but I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't called on that egregious error. There are clubs now in San Jose. That's the nearest city I can think of. I believe there's some further up the mid-peninsula as well, but again, the guy's trying to make an argument to ban all new medical marijuana clubs, and he's pulling false information out of the air and giving it to the city council. This is a department, a planning department, that has had a year. It has been, all the rules were suspended that would have allowed these two applicants last summer to press for the right to open a new club. And they would have had to go through a very extensive process, and it would have had to be a 600-foot setback from this and that and everywhere else. But this planning department, and I don't know if it was the initiative of Mike Ferry, or whether it was he's simply the agent of the guy who brings the bad news, but they moved to stop these, to freeze these applications, and now to kill them. So they did this claiming they needed a year to study the issue. They have not come up with significantly new information from, as far as I can see, from their June statements, although I guess at least we're getting a few numbers now that we didn't have before, but it's the same claim. Oh, we're overwhelmed by phone calls. Well, their job is to deal with phone calls. Again, the basic issue here is, as I write about it on the web, marijuana dispensaries, pharmacies, bars, yes, certainly they could be regulated one way or another, but if you're going to allow the proliferation of some of these and then declare that one is so dangerous or there's such a real question, or you're not even going to say why, because it will make you sound like a prohibitionist idiot, but you do it anyway as though there were some real serious bad aspect to marijuana use, then you're trying to have one over on the people of Santa Cruz. And I have to say, even the folks on the topics, the Sentinel topics, which is usually very right-wing, hates homeless people, denounces homeless rights activists, can't find a bad word to say about the Santa Cruz Police Department, finds many of the writers there find this absurd and ridiculous, because there's a recognition, you know, that if it stinks like a drug prohibitionist, it probably is a drug prohibitionist, however much of a sunny, Rotkin-esque smile it masquerades under.
About our research, most of the agencies that we went to specifically don't allow medical marijuana rules and dispensaries. So right in their ordinances, it's just not an allowed use. We currently have no regulations that address the potential number of dispensaries that can operate in the city. We have no rules and regulations that regulate the size of a dispensary. The number of grow houses is independent, and the sizes of the grow houses, no regulations on that. We believe that there could be an impact from an overconcentration of dispensaries, production houses, in the community as a whole.
This is an assertion. See if you can hear any evidence for that assertion. An impact. What impact?
Developed these rules, we worked with other city staff, the city police department. We worked with the county sheriff's office, a special investigator over there, and developed the rules that we're presenting tonight. So
they worked with agencies that were anti-marijuana from the word go, that enforce drug laws against marijuana, that helped to cripple the Measure K measure, the Measure K Commission, I should say, passed by the voters in 2006, which is supposed to make marijuana use, whether recreational or medical, in private places, the lowest priority, the lowest enforcement priority. In a way, it's good that Mike here is being very clear about where his information and his priorities are coming from. But it speaks kind of yards and reams for the city council that they act as though this is some objective, unbiased source, or this is something that they should pay attention to. These are the people. These are the viewpoints from these departments, the prohibitionist mentality, that have wreaked havoc in the drug war for the last six decades. And this is now the siren voice that the city council is listening to.
As many agencies as we could find within the state that did regulate medical marijuana. The Planning Commission heard this particular item on November 5th, At that hearing, there was a lot of questions about the quantities of marijuana that could be grown, and there was a lot of questions about how the dispensaries operate at a not-for-profit, as a not-for-profit business. The Planning Commission asked us to come back with additional information, and on November 9th, we met again, and they voted 5-2 to recommend council approval of the ordinances as we had them. They had some minor corrections. We've incorporated those into the document before you tonight. The minutes to those, both of those meetings are attached to your report. So I'll go through some slides. One of the first things that we looked at was actually based on the existing dispensaries. They both wanted to be able to offer the sale of clones to patients. So we're proposing to modify the definition of medical marijuana dispensary to include cultivation so that clones can be produced on site and sold to the clients. We think that that will limit some potential land use conflicts between houses or areas that the product's grown and neighbors. There could be potential conflicts with transporting. Also provides a controlled environment where the dispensary can see the production from start to finish and be guaranteed the quality of the product that they're selling. And then the big seller in our mind was that patients can purchase a clone of a certain type of marijuana that works best for them, take that home. It's a reasonably inexpensive purchase, and grow it themselves. As we discussed the allowance of cultivation, the idea of limiting that area came up. We contacted both dispensaries. The Greenway folks thought that a 2,000-square-foot operation, grow house specifically, would work for them. And we ran some numbers, and this was part of what caused some of the consternation at the first Planning Commission meetings. Since then, we've revised those numbers, and we've got a range for you, and I'll show you where the range comes from in a second. It allows a 2,000-square-foot grow area within a dispensary would allow between 125 and 432 pounds of processed marijuana. That's the actual marijuana that's sold annually, and that would be for each dispensary. To compensate for different types or varieties or quantities, they would still be able to use their outside vendors. So the table that I've got here is it's processed marijuana and clones. The lime kiln facility based their estimate on a legal grow house that they operated in Oakland at the time. The Greenway is an estimate from one of their growers. And to counter those two numbers or to get a different opinion, we asked the sheriff's grow house expert what he thought could be produced.
So they went to the two monopoly providers of marijuana, Lisa Milineau and Ken Sampson, or sellers of marijuana, and to the sheriffs. I mean, there's a reasonable approach, right? No, wrong. You go to other places that do this, not just the people who are here, and find out what their approach is. And presumably you try to talk to the consumers of marijuana, the patients. I don't know. I don't usually have a lot of positive things to say about WHAM, in spite of the very positive image it has nationally, mainly because Valerie Correll has always been pretty much concerned with her own operation and not terribly concerned with decent rules for the rest of us that allow access to the general population for medical marijuana or, for that matter, recreational marijuana. Though there have been some exceptions. I'm glad that when she does step out and speak up, or step up and speak out. You know, even going to her and Mike Corral for some analysis, to other medical marijuana activists in Santa Cruz might have been helpful, or to people who have been working with this issue for years, not just the two people that are the two owners of marijuana clubs that are naturally concerned with keeping their licenses and their operations growing and probably don't mind having a monopoly in Santa Cruz. Again, I haven't heard their testimony on this issue yet, but I have not heard any big protests from Lisa Milineau, who hasn't returned a call to this program in 4 years, it seems like. 3 or 4 years, yeah. and Ken Sampson. I haven't heard them speaking out publicly about the need to have non-prohibitionist rules around dispensaries, rules that treat dispensaries as wellness centers, that treat dispensaries as, yeah, maybe a capitalist venture, and I'm not always a big fan of capitalist ventures, but no worse than a pharmacy, you know, no worse than a bar, and no worse than a hookah lounge. Instead, you know, these aren't limited. There's no specific number of such places that are required in any, you know, in any meaningful, with any meaningful arguments supporting that. I don't know. I'm kind of repeating my arguments. It just seems pretty obvious to me. I'm only going to play a little bit more of this, and then if anybody's interested, and I'll be taking calls on the air, 427-3772, and I will also be listening to any calls that come in the next few days, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833, which is the phone number for me off air and for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And I'll play more of this on Sunday if folks want to hear it. It pisses me off, and it's dispiriting, and it's kind of also old news, because this is like sort of an endless nightmare juggernaut that keeps coming back again and again. We saw it in June. We saw it in July. Then it came up in two planning commission hearings in November. June and July, it was in the city council. Then in January, when the city council said, oh, we haven't given the planning commission enough time to cook up some kind of arguments, and now it's back again in March. And so it's tired, it's old, it's shuffling, it's deadly, it's also kind of boring. So we're not going to spend too much more time on this, but I'll give it a few more moments.
Develops that range. The range is between 125 pounds and 432 pounds, depending on who's giving you the answer. And the difference in clones was 20,000 up to 117,000. So the lime kiln.
Sorry, I mean, are there limits on the number of flowers you can grow? Are there that can be sold by, you know, a greenhouse? Maybe so. I'm surprised if there is, but I kind of doubt it. You know, are there limits on the number of medicines a pharmacy can sell? No, but yet we find it's necessary to limit marijuana. No, we don't. We're allowing, it's like these city council members are being scared or unduly influenced by the police department, the sheriff's department, and the planning department. And it gives a complete lie to any of Mike Rodkin's claims that he's an advocate for any kind of meaningful action against the drug war, against the drug prohibition war in Santa Cruz, which leads to this endless cycle of violence and corruption and incarceration and ruined lives. It's just not. This is in the opposite direction.
That they would require a 10,000 square foot grow house. And we've got the same numbers. Again, Lime Kiln is basing this off of a grow house that they had in Oakland. And the Dubois folks are estimating it. And then the sheriff's counter numbers are on the bottom. So it ranges from 625 pounds a year annually and 2,100 pounds when you look at the sheriff's estimates. And then the clones go from 100,000 to 500,000, 587,000. And in working with the sheriff, he explained that if he was to operate this, he would stack his trays of clones. They can have a real high turnover. And they're done relatively quickly, or ready for sale relatively quickly. So that could be the discrepancy in those two numbers. Since we're proposing that cultivation is allowed in the facilities themselves, we're proposing to eliminate the standalone cultivation that is currently allowed in the ordinance. So in the IG or the EA, with a special use permit, you can operate a grow house with no size limitation. There's no setback requirements. And since the proposed definition of a dispensary includes cultivation now, we're suggesting that this be removed. The solar panel came into play. Again, this was talking with the the sheriff's expert, one of the ways that they find illegal houses is these huge PG&E bills. So I was asked to run those numbers down, and a 2,000-square-foot grow house, if you were just growing to flower plants, would generate about 960 kilowatts per day, or use about 960 per day, and that's in comparison to about 31 for a single family. So we wrote the condition to be, it's not black and white, it's kind of a softer condition.
And I really kind of think I've had enough at the moment. Perhaps you have too, I don't know. I've gotten silence out there. Call in number, in case you want to speak up, is 427-3772. I guess the whole idea of this kind of elaborate set of regulations strikes me as just wrong. Maybe it's an attempt to placate the fears of some members of the population that, you know, there'll be a marijuana distribution center two on every block. You know, kind of like alcohol or tobacco sales. I don't know. I mean, it is true that a number of clubs popped up in L.A., which is a huge area and has millions of people, many clubs, particularly after L.A. strove to regulate them out of existence or to make strict regulations that were not entirely legal. And that's another real issue that we haven't talked about, which is, given Proposition 215, is this really going to be legal once it hits the courts in terms of regulation? Maybe so, and I don't have any experts in the studio. Maybe I can get a few on Sunday to talk about it. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert, and you're listening to Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. Just a couple of announcements. There is, I understand it from looking on Indy Bay, tonight from 5 to 7, so it's almost over, and I apologize for not mentioning it earlier, there's a Sub Rosa Cafe speaker who's talking about the squatting movement in Barcelona. According to this is a presentation by Peter G., an anarchist living in Spain, an author of How Nonviolence Protects the State. Wow, that's one of my, the books, I don't know, one of my favorite books, but it's certainly a stimulating book I was reading on the air at different points, and unfortunately it's conflicting with my show time. Boy, maybe I can zip over there after the show, or maybe get a tape of his presentation if somebody made one. The squatting movement, according to this description of Peter G., is part of an anarchist struggle in Barcelona as an analysis of how the Barcelona squatting movement furthers the local anarchist struggle and how it hinders it. There'll be a presentation on the squatting movement, again, at the Sub Rosa 5 to 7, a possible additional presentation by an anarchist from Greece on the book We Are an Image from the Future, the Greek Revolts of December 2008, and there'll be an open mic following. So that's happening at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific, which is a block up from Laurel toward the beach, for any of you who want to check that out. And if you do, and it's interesting, call in and let me know how it goes. I also want to announce, got a call from Drum Circle Dave, who may well be listening, and who knows, maybe he'll call in and mention it himself, but he called me today and said that on Wednesday, yesterday at the Drum Circle, Derek, and I'm not sure if his name is Cookie or Tubi, keeled over and died in the Drum Circle. He died on the mandala, playing a big natural skin djembe drum, and folks kind of grabbed him by the chest to hold him. He was about 50 or more, according to Drum Circle Dave. No one knew him there. He just showed up and was playing his drum. Fire truck came, and they tried to do CPR. According to Dave, they pumped his stomach, leaving the contents of his stomach on the sidewalk. They loaded him in the ambulance like he was alive, but he was dead. He was turning blue. They gave him some fluid, that apparently didn't work. A lot of people speculated he was high on heroin or drunk, but he was playing fairly well, according to Drum Circle Dave. In response, a lot of the drummers kind of got up and left, but Dave spoke up and said he wanted to play in honor of the guy, so a number of them stayed, a few came back. Police wanted the thing to stop, according to Dave, and
It didn't. They continue to play. That happened between 3 and 6 yesterday, a death at the drum circle, the death of the unknown drummer at the drum circle yesterday, downtown Santa Cruz, on the now pay parking lot number 4, next to the farmer's market. Anybody has more information about that, feel free to call in and talk about it, 427-3772. Yesterday was also, I believe, yesterday or Tuesday,
was a vote in the House of Representatives on U.S. out of Afghanistan resolution presented by Dennis Kucinich. And there was a disgraceful situation, a disgraceful vote. Uh, 65 people out of 435 voted to have the troops withdraw by the end of the year from Afghanistan. The rest apparently are going to continue the slaughter and the occupation over there. That's under the leadership, of course, of President Obama. A couple of good speeches were made, and some of them were played on Democracy Now! This morning. And you can also go to democracynow.org to listen to it. There's one that wasn't, that I listened to, that was pretty good. Let's see if I can find it online. I'm not quite sure how Representative Farr voted. By Sunday, I should know about that. I kind of suspect, I'm afraid he probably voted with the with the bad guys, with the Obamatons, I guess we might call them. Let's see here. 5 Republicans did vote to pull out of Afghanistan, along with 60 Democrats. And let's see here. We may have... I'm looking for the... There's an audio. That doesn't seem to be... Here we go. This is the audio. Maybe we can play it here and see how it goes. Let me make sure I have my duckies set up here. I've got to be careful. Let's stop this. Make sure we're ready to boogie here. Get to hear all the inner workings of the studio. It must be pretty exciting out there for you. Here, this is Ron Paul speaking in favor of the resolution of the U.S. get out of Afghanistan. Original co-sponsors of Dennis Kucinich's bill include Representatives John Conyers, Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, Jose Serrano, Democrat of New York, Bob Filner, Democrat of California, Lynn Woolsey, Democrat of California, Walter Jones, Jr., Republican of North Carolina, Danny Davis, Democrat of Illinois, Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, Michael Capuano, Democrat of Massachusetts, Raul Grijalva, Democrat of Arizona, Tammy Baldwin, Democrat of Wisconsin, Timothy Johnson, Republican of Illinois, Yvette Clark, Democrat of New York, Eric Massa, also New York guy, Democrat, Alan Grayson, Democrat of Florida, and Shelley Pingy, Democrat of Maine, and there were about 45 or 50 others who voted along with it. Let's see if there's actually, if we can find anybody we recognize. It's directed the President to pursuant to Section 5C of the War Powers Resolution to remove the United States Armed Forces from Afghanistan. And by no later than the end of the period of 30 days, beginning on the day in which this resolution is adopted, or if it's not safe to do that, by December 31st. I don't know why it wouldn't be safe. Anyway, here's what Ron Paul says about that. Well,
The gentleman from Ohio for bringing this issue up. It is late. This war started 10 years ago. It's about time we talked about it. It was said earlier on, it is hard to quit a war, and we shouldn't be quitting. But I'll tell you what the real problem is. It's too easy to start a war. It's too easy to get involved, and that is our problem. The founders of this country tried very hard to prevent this kind of a dilemma that we're in now. Getting involved in no-win wars and nobody knowing exactly who the enemy is. The war was started and justified by quoting and using the War Powers Resolution written in 1973. That was written after the fiasco of Vietnam to try to prevent the problems of slipping into war. Yet that resolution in itself was unconstitutional because it literally legalized war for 90 days. So it did exactly the opposite. So here we are, the 90-day permission for war at that time now is close to 10 years. I'm afraid that this is a little bit too little, hopefully not too late for us to do something about this. Are we going to do it for 10 more years? How long are we going to stay? And the enemy is said to be the Taliban. Well, the Taliban, they certainly don't like us, and we don't like them. And the more we kill, the more Taliban we get. But I want to quote the first line of the resolution passed back in 2001. What the purpose of giving the president the power, which was an illegal transfer of power to the president to pursue war at will. It said the authorities to authorize the use of United States armed forces against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States. The Taliban didn't launch an attack against the United States. The government of Afghanistan didn't launch it. The best evidence is that of those 20 individuals, two of them might have passed through Afghanistan. A lot of the planning was done in Germany and Spain, and the training was done here in the United States. Oh, yes, the image is that they all conspired, a small group of people, with bin Laden, they made this decision. Right now, the evidence is not there to prove that, but certainly bin Laden was very sympathetic, loved it, and wanted to take credit for it. And one of the reasons why he wanted to take credit was that he said it would do three things for what he wanted. First, it would enhance his recruitment efforts for al-Qaeda and his attack against Western powers who have become overly involved in control of the Middle East and have had a plan for 20 years to remake the Middle East. He also said that the consequence of 9/11 will be that we will bog the American people down in a no-win war and demoralize the people. And they're working on it. There's still a lot of moral support, but there's a lot of people in this country now. The country is totally bankrupt, and we're spending trillions of dollars on these useless wars. The people will become demoralized because history shows that all empires end because they expand too far and they bankrupt the country just as the Soviet system came down. And that's what bin Laden was hoping for. He also said that the dollar spent will bankrupt this country. And we are bankrupt, and yet there is no hesitation to quit spending 1 cent overseas. We built embassies in Baghdad, we built embassies in Kabul, billion-dollar embassies, fortresses, and it's all necessary. Nobody is really concerned. If people were concerned about the disastrous effect of debt on this country, we would change our foreign policy and we would be safer for it. We are not safer because of this foreign policy. It's a policy of intervention that has been going on for a long time, and it will eventually end. This war is an illegal war. This war is an immoral war. This war is an unconstitutional war. And the least you could say it's illegitimate. There's no real purpose in this. The Taliban did not attack us on 9/11. Do you know, after we went in to Afghanistan, immediately the concerns were shifted to remaking the Middle East. We went into Iraq. Use this as a justification. It was nothing more than an excuse. Most Americans, the majority of Americans, still believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And I imagine most Americans believe the Taliban had something to do with 9/11, and it's not true. We need to change our foreign policy and come back to our senses and defend this country and not pretend to be the policeman of the world.
Gentlemen's time has expired.
And that was Ron Paul on the floor of the House of Representatives yesterday, I believe. One of 65 votes trying to use the War Powers Act to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan in 90 days, or maybe it's 30 days. Let me double check again. But in any case, it was voted down big time, 65 to 356. I did check the roster of votes, and Representative Sam Farr of our district did vote in favor of this resolution to get out of U.S. To get the U.S. out of Afghanistan. Good work, Sam. Thank you for that vote. Now all you got to do is vote against the military budget and stop funding the murdering going on over there, and maybe we can take it seriously, other than as some sort of, you know, crowd pleaser for the liberal area here. Because unless you, if you vote them the guns, then they're going to go do it. If you vote them the money, they're going to go do it. And that Farr has continued to do. So that's how that goes. I'm going to begin some street interviews because I'm behind, and folks on the street do deserve an opportunity to speak. So this is their opportunity. I think we are talking late February here, but I think the date's going to come up in the course of these interviews, so here we go. Again, for those of you who are tuning in because they're hoping to hear the discussion of Doug Loiselle's plan to expand homeless shelter, which, by the way, there was a plan to continue funding the armory, which the city council voted 2 days ago. They usually, the armory is funded till April 15th for those who are able to use it and can stomach it, and who, for whom it's a possibility, which is not necessarily even a majority of the homeless population. Certainly not a majority. It's a small minority of the homeless population because the armory is full at 75, and sometimes they cram in 100, sometimes even more. But you're talking 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people outside, so it's kind of a joke if you talk about it as a meaningful alternative. And it's going to become an issue in a week when Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon go to a judge in front of Judge Volkman in Department 4, I believe, at 9 o'clock with attorneys Mark Briscoe and Jonathan Gettleman defending them. They're going to face 15 days apiece for supposedly sleeping in Santa Cruz, violating the sleeping ban. It's a really kind of a slimy and triply illegal approach that City Attorney John Barisoni is using here. It's kind of interesting. We know the sleeping ban, of course, is illegal and or is unconstitutional and a violation of human rights. It says homeless people can't sleep after 11 o'clock at night. That was kind of universally recognized even by its supporters, and sleeping ban was made an infraction, I think, over Mike Rotkin's objections in 1999, in February, when the issue came to last came to City Council in any really meaningful form. They didn't eliminate it, as Richmond has, as Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Laguna Beach have, some of them under court pressure. But it was changed to a mere infraction, which supposedly means you only get a fine or community service, or if you don't attend to those things, you know, you get your credit rating gets destroyed as your stuff gets sent south, as your unattended tickets go south. But City Council took that a step further a year ago and made three unattended infractions a misdemeanor charge. Now that, as far as I know, has not been used, although now I still haven't heard of a verified case of that being used by the city attorney or by the district attorney. So it may have been just sort of one of those threats that they were using, which supposedly it's really to drive homeless people away because, although ironically, it'll bring them back. If people are in town, get tickets, and they feel they have to come back and deal with them, then they're going to be coming back to town even though they have no place to stay, and the cycle continues. But the whole point is to say, get out of town, you can't sleep here, otherwise we're going to punish you with a ticket. That's the whole notion of the sleeping ban and similar laws against sitting around downtown. Get out of here. Go away. We don't want you here. You don't have the same rights as everybody else. And that's the problem with those kinds of laws. But, again, this particular thing that's coming up next week is, as I say, particularly interesting because when this injunction against these two individuals was granted, this is a very kind of a particular law. It was a court order. Named these two people. They were accused of all kinds of different things, but the court order just said, well, you can't sleep in the downtown area, Pacific Avenue, adjoining streets, and so forth. specifically, even though it's illegal to do that right now, we make it a contempt of court issue. So if you sleep there, it's not just a ticket. You get taken immediately to jail. Well, police claimed that they found them violating this law on three different occasions and gave them tickets for it, but didn't take them to jail or into court. So that was kind of interesting. One wondered why that was. Maybe because they didn't want to try to enforce so ridiculous an injunction, because there was, you know, no legal place for people to sleep, at least for the overwhelming majority of people to sleep. I will continue with my tirade after, of course, giving priority to this caller. Hi, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert.
Hello.
I want to talk to you about some basic, animal things to do with sleep.
Okay.
And there was a couple of experiments that were done, and they did that. They observed ducks that were arranged on a log. They were all sitting on the log during the night. And they found that the ducks on either end, let's say the duck on the right end, had its right eye open and its left eye closed in sleep. So half the brain was sleeping.
Uh-huh.
The duck on the other end had its left eye open and its right eye closed, right brain sleeping.
This is a great approach. We can recommend this to the homeless. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is the ducks in the middle had both eyes closed. So it's a matter of survival and protection.
Wow.
Now, if you have people out there, well, let's take it one step back. Our society has evolved to such a point that we feel we're protected. You know, we're in our homes, so we can go into deep REM sleep, and we don't have to have one eye open for fear of being killed. However, the homeless do have that fear, so they cannot get a good night's sleep. And I have an article, I'll send it to you, and I think it was from the New York Times, and it said what a detrimental thing sleep deprivation is. And you know, sleep deprivation in some context is considered torture.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's also, we tried to bring in medical experts to couple the trials about 10 years ago under the sleeping ban, to get testimony specifically that sleep is a necessity for, and if you don't get sleep, you can't work, you can't function properly, and so forth. The
right.
response of Tom Kelly, Kangaroo Kelly, as we called that judge, although he's a nice guy, he's a political hack in this respect, and he said, well, they can sleep during the day, can't they? That's his response.
No, we're not wired that way.
Well, that's true, and it's also you can't really work. Most people, we have a 15% unemployment rate now in Santa Cruz County, highest in its history, probably not since the Depression, but recent history for sure, according to the Sentinel, and I don't think you get a lot of jobs at night available for anybody, particularly for homeless people. I guess maybe night watchmen might be available.
So, like I said, I'll get that article, and it's documentation. I think it was from the New York Times, but I think you'll find it interesting.
Okay.
One other thing is that the sheriff's department, I believe they put their officers on rotating shifts so that a certain amount of time you'll have day, a certain amount of time you'll have swing, a certain amount of time you'll have graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
That messes up their circadian rhythms all to hell.
Really?
And
because you have friends who are sheriffs and so forth, or
yes, I do.
Uh huh. Okay.
And by doing that, you create I'll go a step psychological imbalance.
Have unions picked up this issue and tried to establish some rights for the deputies around this issue?
I do not know that, but I think there are certain people who are just suited to graveyard. They like it.
Mm-hmm.
Let them do it. Don't move them to day shift where they have to shift everything. You're working on negative human psychology from both ends. You're waking up the homeless and you're messing with the police.
And that's a really bad combination as well. But if you can find out more from any sources you have as to whether this has ever been an issue and whether the management has ever responded to this concern or whether the unions,
I think it'd be interesting.
Yeah, let me know because I'd like to know about it.
Okay, and is your address in the phone book?
My email address is rnorris3@hotmail.com. Are you talking about sending me something by snail mail?
Snail mail, because that's all
I can do. Yeah, my snail mail address is 309 Cedar PMB 14B Santa Cruz 95060. Again, 309 Cedar PMB 14B Santa Cruz 95060. And I appreciate the call.
Okay. After Cedar and between 14B, what was that?
309 Cedar PMB.
Oh.
Pretty mean bastard, PMB.
Okay.
All right.
I'll shoot that off to you.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And phone lines are open, 427-3772. Again, I was talking about this strange hearing that's coming up 9 o'clock a week from tomorrow in Department 4 to force two homeless, it's going to punish these two homeless musicians for three citations they got. They're going to try to give them 15 days in jail each, 240 hours of community service each, and thousands of dollars to reap in fines or restitution to repay the city attorney. I pointed out that they got three citations. The three citations mentioned, apparently, they aren't even all citations. Some of them are just police reports of citations, so they weren't given even the tickets to some of them, or at least to one of them. That's what I hear from Attorney Gettleman today. The three citations, all of them are for sleeping during the day, not sleeping at night. So they don't really violate the nighttime sleeping ban. They claim that these three were camping with intention to remain overnight. But you have to prove intention to remain overnight as a part of the camping part of the sleeping ordinance, unless you have a judge who's willing to sort of, I guess, fall asleep on you and say that's fine, which unfortunately I'm noticing judges increasingly are doing in our courts on the rather basic issues. So they aren't even charged with sleeping at night. They're charged with sleeping during the day. And what is meant by that is lying on a blanket during the day. So they're going to be accused of violating an injunction against sleeping at night but they're really charged that instead they're cooking up this other thing which says camping during the day. They haven't gotten a trial on any of these charges. They're just police contacts which are going to be the basis for an immediate claim of contempt of court in the so-called civil injunction process that is being used by City Attorney John Barisone. So I'm going to be researching this a little more tomorrow, and I'll have more information on Sunday. I'm thinking of doing some tabling downtown to encourage people to sign a petition around this issue or just to express their opinion. And a number of us are also going to go to trial for singing political songs outside the bookshop Santa Cruz because at 3 o'clock and or 2 o'clock, 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they're in that range. At the traditional place where people do political tabling in front of the bookshop in what's called a free speech zone. Apparently not very free anymore. The charge for those citations is $450, which is about three times the charge for sleeping. So singing is considered much more of a menace than sleeping, which perhaps is as it should be. So anyway, I may be doing some tabling down there and doing some singing down there. I think one should be allowed to sing on Pacific Avenue, even if somebody on the second floor is trying to sleep during the day, even if that person has a night job. And they prefer to have their window open. They want the traffic to be quiet for them. I understand that kind of feeling, but I have to say people on the street who are engaging in political protests, which may involve singing, which may involve even shouting at times, during the normal daytime hours have the right to do that. And if the police are just in a knee-jerk and robotic fashion enforcing citations against folks for doing that, even if that means posing as a neutral party and saying, well, we're just citing you so you have to go to court, it actually exerts a very repressive aspect, repressive influence on people. I don't know that anybody's gone back to the bookshop and done any singing since that point. Maybe I should go do that tonight afterward before 10 o'clock. Maybe I will. Time to whip out your ticket books, I guess. I don't know. We'll see. So anyway, that's coming up a week from tomorrow, and it's an important issue, and hopefully we'll be doing some tabling about it on the street, though that remains to be seen. There's weather and there are other conditions, although the weather has turned sunny, which is great. It's really a great day today. Let's hear some street interviews and maybe some more calls from you. 427-3772 is the call-in number here, and I'll be here and ready to chat with you.
So I'm talking with Dreamcatcher.
And Dreamcatcher, here we are at the Sub Rosa Cafe at about 11:30 on March 3rd, in the middle of a Huff meeting. You've just let us know that you actually were part of a settlement that got $2,200 in San Diego for
Venice Beach.
In Venice Beach.
The LA cops. In Venice Beach against the LA cops.
So tell me what happened there.
I was part of a, what do we call it? And homeless advocacy, since I was homeless, and therefore obviously a part of what was going on there. And Venice Beach was in the process of going to lottery because of the violence of the unorganized placement of vendors during the week and on the weekend.
So previously it had been, what, first come, first serve? Now it was you do a lottery to see if you have a spot on the beach for your act or your whatever you're selling?
Correct. And for generations, these locations have been there and happy to take a man that has like 12 squares, which are 2 feet, you know, it's a 2x2 little square on a 4-foot sidewalk.
Sounds like Santa Cruz.
Exactly. It's cut up like that. To have like 44 of those for like 3 generations and have tables in your wares that you do this every day for, reduced to a box of 4 squares, 4x4. Well, it blew out. It blew out. It split everything. It was a mess. I was there holding the ropes for these markers. That was my job when I got there, was helping vendors unload and load, hold their markers from Friday night to Sunday morning. You had to hold the marker that was designating your squares and however many you wanted. And those markers had to be present. Therefore, you had to be always present from Friday night to get that rope in place before anybody else because of the location of the spot that you know about, which is good. That's how I got involved in Venice Beach, and it all ended up with... Well, I was too much present, so therefore when they wanted to clean things up and had their little affairs and parades, well, I got caught up in that many times. Therefore...
What do you mean? Do you mean that you
arrested and lost everything just like that?
What were you selling?
What was I selling? I was not and never an official vendor. Mm-hmm. I was helping the vendors.
That's right. You were helping hold places for them.
Yeah.
So what was the example of the procedure for a typical arrest?
Warrants for sit-down tickets.
So, in other words, you had previously been sitting illegally elsewhere in Venice, criminal that you are, and they found you and just nabbed you and took you into custody.
Because of a no-show on a sit-down ticket.
So you were a known scofflaw, fugitive, fleeing from your rightful punishment for sitting illegally, and you were brought to book. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, that's my condition right now at the moment. Here.
Dream catcher, indeed. Call you rather dream snatcher.
Only my friends can do that.
You say you got a settlement out of all this. How did that happen?
Well, we won because the judge favored in our behalf because of the proper procedure that they used to confiscate our personal.
And why was their procedure improper? What did they do?
They said nothing gets taken. It's getting all thrown away. Sorry.
It's the Santa Cruz policy, don't you understand?
Well, that's
actually, it's not the Santa Cruz policy if you're arrested, but if you have a camp that you've left and Ranger Wallace posts it, then he will come back with his work crews probably 3 days later or more and then reportedly destroy it and take all the property and trash it.
I agree with that.
You mean you agree that it happens or you agree that it's a good thing?
I agree that it happens.
Yes, that's where I thought you went. We've been talking with
Dreamcatcher.
So when are you going to kick down some of this $2,200 you got and buy me dinner?
Right now.
Cool. Thank you very much. We'll be going out to a nice, tasty filet mignon. At the Wednesday drum circle, it's around 4:30. The rain is pausing. We have some saxophonists. We're talking to an anonymous individual. What's been happening lately, Anonymous?
We recently won our class action strip search lawsuit against the city of Santa Cruz, California. Our awards range from $6,000 to $180, anywhere in between there. The Wells Fargo banking community has been very good to us. And we'd like to let the community know that we would like to maybe work out a deal where we could buy a piece of land for our campers, i.e. our friend Anna and Lita.
All right. I know that they're facing an injunction on March 19th. So when was this lawsuit finally settled?
I believe it was within the last 30 days, and the checks are only valid for 90 days. So anybody out there needs to be aware of that. It states on it, void after 90 days.
How much did you cash in for?
I was surprised.
A secret?
Pretty much, yeah, because my intent is to put my money towards putting my homeless friends in a safe place where we don't get hassled by rangers or, you know.
First star to the left and straight on till morning.
Pretty much. Other communities have a camping place for their homeless individuals. Why doesn't Santa Cruz have one? Watsonville Fairgrounds isn't local to where our services are.
You're here.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the update. Anyway, it's the 4th of March, 2010. I'm down on Pacific Avenue about 25 to 5. And the chess players, religious fanatics, and Ronnie Curry are just happening to show up at this very fortuitous spot. Could the Lord have something to do with this?
Are you talking to your...
I'm talking to you
on
the tape.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Actually, I was noticing that around the corner near the public bathroom across from the New Leaf, there are like four different groups of people who've been sort of hanging out illegally sitting on the planter boxes, without even the benefit of cover from a Sunday burrito and beanie provider like yourself.
Are the police bothering them?
No, they're doing fine. But it shows me that there's a lot of, need to use the public spaces. Even here we see, for example, criminals standing on the lip of a planter. Can you see that? Probably marijuana plants growing in the planter. Could be, who knows? Probably not. So anything new on your new affair with Ryan Coonerty? Is this going to become a public scandal? What's happening?
I have not.
Certainly.
I have not had any communication with Ryan whatsoever.
Is this because you cut him off? How can you be so cruel?
No. It's just because I'm interacting with Don Lane.
Oh, so now Don has your favors. Is that what's going on
here? Yes. I really like Don Lane.
It's the Project Connect, we're going to be nice for one day deal.
Robert.
Yes.
He's nice. I know.
Or no. Now, this guy is 365 days a year. Meriwether Mike never goes home. He's homeless.
Meriwether Mike. Yeah, Meriwether Mike.
He's merry even when the weather isn't.
Project Connect is a day, I think it's March 31st. I'm not quite sure. I got to get the exact day down. Where there's going to be a variety of homeless services provided, haircuts, manicures, pedicures, feet washing, I don't know, enemas, I don't know what the heck, a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm being a little sarcastic, but, you know, it's nice. It's like the twice-a-year meal at the vet's hall. I mean, that's a good thing. But it's obviously a token. It has nothing to do with providing meaningful services on a regular basis that might have something to do with ending homelessness or acknowledging the needs of people who are houseless by choice, for that matter. So it's... kind of a feel-good thing for upper-middle-class people and service providers who want to justify their existence. That's kind of how I view it. It's also an act of charity for some that, you know, is a positive thing. But since it is a one-day-a-year deal, it's a one-day-a-year deal.
Oh, you're funny.
So,
no, I wish I had problems to report, but I don't.
You can give me some positive reports. I'd like to hear some good news. Perhaps the Vets Hall is reopening. Perhaps tent cities have been established for people outside.
No.
Perhaps Anna and Lito are no longer being.
There's Anna. There's Anna right
now. I know. We're hoping that they'll be on. That Anna may be on the air today. She may show up in the studio.
Hi, Ronnie. I love you, Ronnie.
And she's currently kissing the fair Ronnie and vice versa. Well, and first vice in this case. The hugging just can't stop here on Pacific Avenue.
Why did Adam and Eve get the name? Wait, why did man come up with the name woman? Because he stopped when he saw Eve and he goes, whoa.
Sounds like a sexist joke. A sad situation that a woman of honest intelligence and independence would come up with such a questionable bit of humorism. Anyway, anything more, Renee, before we leave you here lost and alone?
I posted you on Facebook playing chess with me.
Oh, well, of course
really
that was
a flattering picture.
Oh, that's good. Maybe
yeah,
we need
and
to
you're
do
a very good chess player.
Well, I'm better than some, worse than a lot of others. So.
Actually, you're pretty good.
Well, the two of us will have to try another game,
Renee. I know, when I'm not distracted by myriads of homeless youth out here on the street.
Yes, the homeless youth, it's always a problem downtown.
Jeremiah.
I mean, I don't know what to say. It's questionable.
Okay.
Where's my hug? Do I get a hug?
You're not.
Scabies.
I miss. Oh, yeah, scabies. Oh, well, that's very thoughtful of you.
I
appreciate that.
Oh, no, that's...
This about macing, sir. Let's put the word out to the community. What happened here?
I was acting a fool in a drunk tank, and I was kicking the door, so they maced me and threw me in their straight chair.
This was actually once you were in jail already.
Yeah.
And why were you kicking the door of our fine jail cell?
Because they're dirty, stinky, and smell like shit.
Were you alone in the cell, or were others having to witness your tirade and outburst?
I was in my own cell.
Now, what about this restraint chair you mentioned? What is this?
6-point restraints in a chair, and you sit up.
Describe what this means for those who don't understand what 6-point restraints means.
They restrain you around your chest, your hands to the arms of the chair, and your legs to the feet of the chair.
Is there some kind of muzzle about your face or not?
No. Well, it's only for spitting at them. They put a spit mask on you.
And
but they pepper sprayed me. So.
And why? They pepper sprayed you after you'd been pounding on the door or just for the sort of as an experiment to see how you'd respond?
I have no idea.
You were drunk as a skunk.
No, I was buzzed. Not drunk.
But, oh, so you say you do remember it then?
I told them it smelled like shit in here and they wouldn't move me out of that cell, so I kicked the door until they let me out.
And they came, when they opened the door, they both let you out and pepper sprayed you?
They maced me once they opened the door. That was fun.
Now, is there a difference between mace and pepper spray, or are you using the terms identically?
Yeah. I don't know what the hell they use in those things, but it burns.
Did they then wash your eyes out? Or?
Oh, yeah. They got me water, of course.
Did the deputies make any comments as they sprayed you?
No, I heard them laughing, though.
Well, you can't blame them. After all, it's a lot of fun to pepper spray someone who's under your control.
It sucks.
Wouldn't you agree, Renee?
Robert!
You see, we have the innocence of the older Renee. Anyway, we've been talking with...
Jeremiah.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Mayweather, Mike, you're here with your instrument. Is this amplified sound? And do you have a permit for this? What is it? It's a Casio multifunction display keyboard. I mean, have the police stopped you and told you to shape up?
Details. The devil's in the details. That's what I think. And they never tell us the details. They just gloss them over. But
you've never been hassled for this.
Well, yeah. You know, it just depends who, what, where, and when. And right now, we're just going to be the who, and the what is love, and the where, as usual, the garden mall. And we won't care whose nose is in the air, because here comes the petition lady. So if you're not an activist, at least you can do is sign a petition. We're going to legalize the green bud and a lot of other love.
And hopefully provide a little donation to this woman who's attempting to get some dental work done, for God's sake.
Here comes the Meister Sampler himself. Look, he's ducking out. He knows I'm talking about him.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Meriwether Mike.
talking with a regular musician. Your name, sir?
Well, I eat oatmeal in the morning, you know. It kind of helps.
Cheerios or Wheaties?
Nah, mostly oatmeal or just coffee and eat later.
That keeps it more regular than Cheerios. But do you have a place to, should we say, make regular deposits in downtown Santa Cruz?
Well, there's a couple of public bathrooms around here. I think they open at 8, and the bus station, you know, is late.
This reminds me of Hank in Berkeley years ago. He used to carry one of these things in his pocket, and he'd go down on Telegraph Avenue, and he'd interview people. Then he'd go home and type it out, mimeograph it into books, go out on the avenue, and sell the mimeograph books while he interviewed people with his recorder on to make his next edition.
That's a brilliant plan. I have to use that in my next life, perhaps.
You have to call it Hank. Hank with an exclamation point.
Is this Hank the religious fanatic Hank or another Hank?
No, he wasn't religious fanatic. He was more of a psychedelic fanatic.
Oh, that's good. A little fanaticism can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Where do I
sign up? Do you have a bad memory? Why are you using this thing?
For free radio. I'm doing a show at 6 o'clock.
So. Oh, need material, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, it's... Actually, I'm covering the idea of, the problems with street performers. You, Jay, have a guitar on your back. Now, this tends to indicate your tendency to... Well, there's a threat you may pull out at any time and start to play.
I got a banjo, and I'm not afraid to use it either.
There you are. Now, you say police have not been bothering you.
Well, they haven't been, but I know they just kind of ignore me and...
Because they like your beard, perhaps.
They probably like the beard, but...
If you tend to be a good player, an authentic player, they tend to leave you alone. They have a respect for that, and that's respectable of them. Yeah. I'm a player, by the way. That's my guitar strapped to my bike over there.
Oh, ho! And what is your name, guitar man?
My name's Clint, and I play a lot, and I'm loud. And people neither have thrown things at me, nor have the cops bothered me.
Have they thrown money at you?
They have.
Well, that's
people
excellent.
Give me money and buy my CDs, and... I think there is a certain element of respect for authentic musicianship, which is nice to know. You know.
Now, do you have any songs that are original and specific to Santa Cruz that you play?
Not yet. I've only been here for 3 months, so...
Well, let's get busy, Clint.
Well, I... Even Merle Haggard said you can't write them on purpose. It just doesn't work. You just got to wait until the light goes off. Though I did write I wrote this fabulous, six-verse, huge, long song one morning about a week ago in a yellow notebook. That afternoon, I lent the notebook to a kid to help him learn how to play guitar, and he never gave me the notebook back.
But that was only a week ago, so it may come back yet.
I remember the gist of the song, and it wasn't
bad. Would you like to sing it a cappella, perhaps?
Oh, God, that's a challenge, man. It went something like this. Okay, this is really a challenge, but it went something like... I was imagining my band, my great band. Okay, this is going to have a number of pieces, horns. It's going to have Tibetan cymbals and the Tibetan big brass horn, and yet be rhythm and blues kind of oriented. But the chorus, which is a real chorus, is a whole bunch of people singing here, like males and females, and they're singing. In my meditation... In my meditation, like that. That's the chorus, and the verses go: In my meditation, the pornographic billion-dollar commerce of fashion elitism that addicts young women to constant self-display for the illusion of gaining a status inside of a capitalistic society that gives them the worth of their beauty disintegrates in the atomic vaporization of these illusions. In my meditation, in my meditation, in my meditation, the weapons manufacturers who belong to the unions and have their 24-hour-a-day production crews and lines and have their ambassadors to other countries looking for potential conflicts for whom to order new weapons systems, they vaporize in their atomic irrelevance in the face of what really is a cosmic mind of love. love. In my meditation, in my meditation. Well, like that.
And we've been listening to the original music of
Clint.
Thank you, Clint. All right, so there seems to be, we've seen a few people with signs walking along the avenue, support our schools, UC tuition shouldn't go for construction. And coming up Pacific Avenue, now crossing the Regal Cinema 9, we have people who have taken the street with signs, no more cuts, they're shouting. We are the budget. We are the budget cut.
And this was a week ago, today being the 11th. That was the 4th, March 4th on Pacific Avenue, day of protest against the budget cuts. I'm not quite sure what happened on March 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and today around this issue. And I never got a call from anyone who was in the protest to give me the follow-up. But I'm sure some people may be following up. You can probably go to Occupy California website and get more information about that. And I did play the tape on this, and that was good. I enjoyed it. Some of it was good, and you can catch that show by going into the archives. All these shows, including this one, soon, takes a day or two, will be archived at www.huffsantacruz.org. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a much outdated website that still has, unfortunately, relevant information because the laws don't change at all, and just the names change, and the judges change, and the cops change, but the grim system remains. So, got about half an hour left in the show. Maybe it's time for a article or two.
I usually don't have much time for, but who knows? Maybe I can actually eke out a little here and see what I've got. Well, there were some interesting comments made about the medical marijuana dispensary ban, the new medical marijuana dispensary ban. They're going to allow the two existing clubs to continue and actually give them grow houses. We do. Or let them create their own grow houses and grow their own stuff and sell it at a hefty profit. There was not much, and this was a point that was made by a critic on IndieBay, where I've written a lot of stuff about the medical marijuana dispensary ban issue that came up at City Council on Tuesday and passed unanimously. Anything those reefer madness folks says is great. In other words, it's okay to go along with the drug warriors because, after all, we don't want to be accused of being soft on crime, you know, that sort of thing. There were some interesting... the issue of profiteering was an interesting one, which hasn't really been addressed. I mean, a number of people claim that the two clubs are profiteering, and it's kind of hard to tell, you know, what's going on. Even to have candid conversations with the owners or the workers at the clubs. I noticed the clubs have very restrictive rules, some of which have been imposed by the city council, such as they will run you, they'll not only expel you if you smoke a joint on public property legally in, the Harvey West area, but they will send a letter to authorities, seeking to remove your legitimacy as a medical marijuana patient as well. Again, part of the city council's very repressive ordinance passed in 2000, which is supposed to be, you know, such a wide open ordinance that now they have to ban new medical marijuana clubs and change the ordinance to make it even worse and include more setbacks for more places. It's just drug prohibition war. It's the kind of stuff that I think sensible people have been rejecting for decades and just been shaking their heads as the number of marijuana busts, including in Santa Cruz, has gone up month after month, year after year, at least in recent years, for sure. according to the statistics of the Measure K Commission, which doesn't bother to examine whether the police department is following the law or not. They just take their word for it. Here's a statement that was online from the Sentinel website. Don't forget that we get to vote in November to legalize adult use possession growing of personal amounts of marijuana in California. While that won't change this law against more dispensaries, it will allow a lot more of us to grow our own. It will bring down street prices and ultimately dispensary prices. It will allow more sharing of marijuana without the exchange of money, just as we more freely share other crops we grow ourselves. And it will provide a safer opportunity for small-scale sales of marijuana among friends, or as I like to call it, pottage industry. There you go. By limiting the number of dispensaries, the council has essentially ensured that the slack will continue to be picked up by local entrepreneurs, most of whom are not gang-related. In the economy, that could be seen as a blessing. I don't know about that conclusion. That one kind of escapes me, but some of the other stuff is sort of interesting theory. I'd like if some of that happened, and I'd like to see passage of some legalization measure, although it's been pointed out that the measure that looks like it's made the ballot is not the best measure and does kind of provide special privileges for dispensaries and special restrictions in cities and doesn't address the problem of people in jail at the present time. So here is a story about Marja. I don't know if you've been reading about Marja. Marja is a town. It's actually not a town. It is I guess it's kind of a crossroads and farmers, a collection of huts in Afghanistan that has been made the PR center of the U.S.'s latest aggressive attacks on the Taliban. You know, the people who were not the terrorists that blew up the 9/11 towers, the ones, you know, that are... This is the U.S. is defining a particular group as terrorist, and then anybody who supports them in one way or another, or even wants to talk about them in a non-critical way, faces risk of providing material support to those groups, and thus being an enemy combatant, or violating laws around that issue. Yes, under the liberal Obama. But here's a story by Gareth Porter, Fiction of Marja as City was U.S. Misinformation. For weeks, the U.S. public followed the biggest offensive of the Afghanistan war against what it was told was a city of 80,000 people, as well as the logistical hub of the Taliban in that part of Helmand, a province of Afghanistan. That idea was a central element in the overall impression built up in February that Marja was a major strategic objective more important than other district centers in Helmand. It turns out, however, that the picture of Marja presented by military officials and obediently reported by major news media is one of the clearest and most dramatic pieces of misinformation of the entire war, apparently aimed at hyping the offensive as a historic turning point in the conflict. Marja is not a city or even a real town, but either a few clusters of farmers' homes or a large agricultural area covering much of the southern Helmand River Valley. It's not urban at all, an official of the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, who asked not to be identified, admitted to IPS Sunday. I think IPS is the news agency that put this out. He called Marja a rural community. It's a collection of village farms with typical family compounds, said the official, adding that the homes are reasonably prosperous by Afghan standards. Richard B. Scott, who worked in Marja as an advisor on irrigation for the U.S. Department of International Development as recently as 25, agrees that Marja has nothing that could be mistaken as being urban. It is an agricultural district with a scattered series of farmers' markets, Scott told IPS in a telephone interview. The ISAF, International Security Assistance Force official, said the only population numbering tens of thousands associated with Marja is spread across many villages and almost 200 square kilometers. Kilometer is it's 2.2 miles on a side, or about 125 square miles. I'm sorry, 2.2 kilometers makes up a square mile. I think that's what it is. Marja has never, ever been incorporated, according to the official, but now there are plans to formalize its status as an actual district of Helmand Province. The official admitted that the confusion about Marjah's population was facilitated by the fact that the name has been used both for the relatively large agricultural area and for a specific location where farmers have gathered for markets. However, the name Marjah was most closely associated with the more specific location where there are also a mosque and a few shops. That very limited area was the apparent objective of Operation Mushtarak, to which 7,500 U.S., NATO, and Afghan troops were committed amid the most intense publicity given any battle since the beginning of the war. So how did the fiction that Marjah is a city of 80,000 people get started? The idea was passed on to the news media by the U.S. Marines in southern Helmand. The earliest references to news stories to Marjah as a city with a large population have a common origin in a briefing given February 2nd by officials at Camp Leatherneck, the U.S. Marine base there. The AP published an article the same day quoting Marine commanders as saying that they expected 400 to 1,000 insurgents to be holed up in the southern Afghan town of 80,000 people. That language evoked an image of house-to-house urban street fighting. The same story said Marjah was, quote, the biggest town under Taliban control, and called it, quote, the linchpin of the militants' logistical and opium smuggling network. It gave the figure of 125,000 for the population living in, quote, the town and surrounding villages. ABC News followed with a story the next day referring to the, quote, city of Marjah, and claiming that the city and the surrounding area, quote, are more heavily populated, urban, and dense than other places the Marines have so far been able to clear and hold. The rest of the news media fell into line with that image of the bustling, urbanized Marjah in subsequent stories, often using town and city interchangeably. Time magazine wrote about the town of 80,000 February 9th, and the Washington Post did the same February 11th. As Operation Mushtarak began, U.S. military spokesmen were portraying Marjah as an urbanized population center. On February 14th, the second day of the offensive, Marine spokesman Lieutenant Josh Diddams said the Marines were, quote, in the majority of the city at this point. He also used language that conjured images of urban fighting, referring to the insurgents holding some, quote, neighborhoods. After a few days into the offensive, some reporters began to refer to a region, but only created confusion rather than clearing up the matter. CNN managed to refer to Marjah twice as a region and once as the city in the same February 15th article without any explanation for the apparent contradiction. The AP further confused the issue in a February 21st story referring to three markets in town, which covers 80 square miles. A town with an area of 80 square miles would be bigger than such U.S. cities as Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, and Cleveland, but AP failed to notice that something was seriously wrong with that reference. Long after other media had stopped characterizing Marjah as a city, the New York Times was still referring to Marjah as a city of 80,000 in a February 26 dispatch with a Marjah deadline. The decision to hype up Marjah as the objective of Operation Mushtarak by planting the false impression that it is a good-sized city would not have been made independently by the Marines at Camp Leatherneck. A central task of information operations in counterinsurgency wars is establishing the counterinsurgency narrative, according to the Army Counterinsurgency Field Manual as revised under General David Petraeus in 2006. That task is usually done by higher headquarters rather than in the field, as the manual notes. The Counterinsurgency Narrative Manual asserts that the news media directly influence the attitudes of key audiences toward counterinsurgents, their operations, and the opposing insurgency. The manual refers to a war of perceptions conducted continuously using the news media, unquote. General Stanley A. McChrystal, commander of the ISAF, that's the mixed force in Afghanistan, of which the overwhelming majority is U.S. troops, was clearly preparing to wage such a war in advance of the Marjah operation. In remarks made just before the offensive began, McChrystal invoked the language of the counterinsurgency manual, saying, "This is all a war of perceptions." The Washington Post reported February 22nd that the decision to launch the offensive against Marjah was intended largely to impress U.S. public opinion with the effectiveness of the U.S. military in Afghanistan by showing that it could achieve a large and loud victory. The false impression that Marjah was a significant city was an essential part of that message. is from the Inter Press News Service. This is a story by Garth Porter, March 9th. Fiction of Marja as a city was U.S. misinformation, and the point being that the impression was given in numerous articles I remember reading in the Chronicle that this big battle for Marja was some sort of significant urban struggle to uproot, you know, door to door, building to building, these entrenched insurgents who were using farmers as human shields and so forth. And in fact, Marja is simply a large farming area with a few clusters of farmers' homes and a mosque in the central crossroads area of 80,000 people spread out over 125 square miles. Who knows? Maybe it's not worth that, reading you the entire article on that issue, but it seems to me it's interesting. The same day that we, if you go to Democracy Now!, today's Democracy Now! Online, you'll hear an angry Senator Kennedy from Rhode Island, no, I'm sorry, Representative Kennedy from Rhode Island, denouncing the news media for the fact that they only had two reporters in the chambers as this U.S. out of Afghanistan resolution was being presented, and how easily and quickly they fall for the military propaganda, the New York Times, the Washington Post. I guess to some listeners of this station, that's nothing new, and who shouldn't be surprised. But you see it also. You see also a kind of a, well, you see it in Santa Cruz with a lack of protest against the war, the lack of anger at the Obama administration for its betrayal, and its of betrayal is, you know, it's interesting. Is betrayal the appropriate word? It's been pointed out. It's pointed out to me by a guy at 7-Eleven. I was buying some water today that. You know, and I pointed this out to others, that Obama said Afghanistan was the good war. That's kind of go in there and bomb those, get those Afghani, that kill, you know, kill the Taliban, eliminate the this particular force. Why? You know, I guess, you know, the most cynical thing that comes, I guess maybe it's cynical, the most obvious thing that comes to my mind is it's a way of showing either a strong president. It's a way of sort of using the momentum, negative momentum of the Bush administration, the negative momentum of the military wars of the last 8 years to get more political capital. And the strange thing is it seems to have silenced any kind of protest. 65 votes is pretty skimpy showing in the House of Representatives. If you listen to Randy Rhodes, who's ranting about Bush's Iraq occupation, and I think, I don't know about Afghanistan, probably there too, now suddenly she's talking about, nobody cares about this, it's okay, you know, he's helping to uproot these insurgents, they help to free the country from the Taliban. Of course, what you have is you have a corrupt government at the center that was had a joke election 2 months ago, and is simply U.S. intervening on one side of a civil war that has nothing to do with U.S. security, and is historically sort of the graveyard of empires, whether the British Empire or the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire. I mean, it's amazing, and it's too obvious and too many times said to want to repeat it again. So I'm going to stop right here, by cracky. And instead, let's get back to some more street interviews, and who knows, maybe a phone call from somebody out there. 427-3772 is the call-in number, in case anyone dares to call in. You know, it's always a possibility. So let's see.
Down on Pacific Avenue on Friday night, March 5th, 2010. Got this.
Dignified. Try to know what is the matter with us there. Between our narrow prejudice and what we understand. Try to know, but never really know that much. Because we've been looking for that crutch. The outside looking for that crutch. Straight deep looking.
supporters. There's a variety of listeners, all of them legally standing up instead of sitting down, of course. Let me interview them. Gentlemen, are you standing here because you like standing up or because...
We were just looking at the bags of benches, stuff on the chain machine. What was in those?
There's, in other words, you're looking for a score on the street. Is that the story?
Well, maybe it's some sugar, cookies.
Yeah, I see. You think maybe something has been left behind for the poor and the cookie-less?
Yeah, and the cookie-less. Let's see, last time I ate a carrot, it's been a while.
All right. Yeah. Applause.
What's up, Robert? How is it?
Well, that's what I was coming downtown to find out. Actually, I was going to get something to eat, but do you have any reports? We've been listening to the music of...
Ricardo Lopez.
Ricardo Lopez. And what's been happening down here on Friday night? Anything of note? I see no armed uniforms. On the other hand, I see nobody sitting down next to a building. So.
That's because they've had... They're riding two cops deep. I want the citizens to feel safe. Evidently, there's no gang activity or any violent crimes or anything because they can afford to have two cops and the cars running in the right in the middle of Pacific Avenue while they jump out and give a kid a ticket who's playing guitar, but he's sitting down and leaning up against the pole, which is no man's land. But they give him a ticket anyway.
I don't think it's illegal to lean, but I think you must be at least 10 feet from a crosswalk, although the only crosswalk I can see is over there across Soquel Avenue between Borders and the New Leaf.
This corner has a unique law that applies only to it that says if you're on this side of the pole, you have to stand up. If you're on that side of the pole, you can sit down.
That's because of the change-making machine. We know that being within 50 feet of a change-making machine is criminal behavior in Santa Cruz.
Criminal behavior. I'm afraid it's a
criminal behavior if you sit down or panhandle. Otherwise, you can do what you want.
Gateway crime is what it is. It's
all kinds of other sitting behaviors. Even sleeping can follow.
Yeah, sleeping in public could happen. Yeah, relaxing in general.
It's not really appropriate for people of your ilk to relax.
No. We better stay on our toes in this cruel town.
Indeed. Well, again, thank you. We've been talking with...
Ricardo Lopez.
Señor Lopez, gracias.
I'm ready now. I'm ready now. I'm ready.
The Obama aid singer. Here we are at the Didgeridoo City in front of Borders. Let's the sounds of the dew.
And we may have the sounds of a caller in a moment. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Robert.
That's me. Who are you?
This is Scott.
Scope it out, Scott Graham, the notorious critic of People Power.
Yes.
So you have been attending a questionable meetings of the Coastal Commission who are seeking to figure out whether to give the Brommer Broadway bike path, the bridge, a clean bill of health or not, right?
Right.
So this went on all day. I guess you all wandered around, did different things. What came out of that meeting? And well, first of all, give us your pitch. You are an opponent of that particular bridge, pathway, road, whatever, right?
Yes. I mean... I understand a need for a safe connection between 7th Avenue and Frederick Street or that area. But, once they acquire the rail line and have a rail trail, there'll be a superior path to anything that would go through Aronic Gulch. And the other thing is that the way that the Aronic Gulch path is currently put forth, it's not going to be anything that would help bicycle riders at all because they're going to end up in the Yacht Harbor and they're going to have to go up that steep hill out of the Yacht Harbor up to 7th Avenue. And so it's not really of any use to bike riders. The original path that had two bridges where the second bridge would take you up to that upper level, that may have helped bike riders. But since that's been eliminated, basically all they're doing is ruining the green belt by putting a bike path through it.
Now, certain There were a number of bike advocates, however, who I imagine showed up at this hearing to support the Brommer Broadway bike path.
Right, but all that really did, you know, when the commissioners made their comments after, all that really did was make it so that the commissioners were positive that this bike path was a transportation project, whereas, you know, the city has tried to play it off as being an interpretive trail. And so when you get, you know, a bunch of people coming in and saying, we need this safe connection, you know, so we can ride bikes back and forth across the county, that eliminates the city's, you know, bullshit move of this is an interpretive trail.
An interpretive trail, for those who don't know, is?
Well, it would be, you know, some like, you know, trail through a natural area where there would be signs that would tell you, you know, this is the Santa Cruz Tower Plant, and this is, you know, where coho salmon used to live, and then, you know, different signs telling you what the different natural features of the area.
Kind of like an open-air natural history museum.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, mm-hmm. It would just, you know, tell you what the natural features of that area are.
Now,
and then, you know, basically the city added, you know, this interpretive trail thing to try to get this past the Coastal Commission, because there's a thing in the Coastal Commission where, you know, under the Coastal Act, the California Coastal Act, things have to be coastal dependent and the respect to Arana Gulch, because Arana Gulch is an environmentally sensitive habitat area for an endangered species. It also has to be resource dependent. It has to be dependent on the resource of the endangered species. And
now, wait a minute.
A transportation project is neither.
That's a little obscure. So can you dumb that down for us a little, will you, Scott?
Oh, make it so Robert can understand.
Yeah, I want to understand. Yeah.
Well, what it is that in order to be resource dependent, it has to, there has to be some reason for it being part, you know, that this trail would be there, not just to get bicycles back and forth across town, but for some reason that, you know, the resource or the endangered species would be helped by it being there.
That's the tar plant, right?
Right.
Now, what exactly is a tar plant? I don't think I've ever known what that is.
Well, it's actually a small sunflower.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, a lot of us think tar plant, schmar plant. You've seen one tar plant, you've seen them all. On with the show.
Hey, can you hang on a second?
Okay.
All right.
We're talking with Scott Graham, or we were a moment ago, about the Coastal Commission's decision, perhaps, or perhaps non-decision, whether to allow the Brommer Broadway bike path, or I guess that's what it is, path through the wilderness area, one of the green belts in Santa Cruz that sort of separates Santa Cruz from the 7th Avenue area on that side of the city. I guess it's the south side or the east side. I'm not quite sure how to always get turned around on those issues. But I think we may have lost Scott. Scott? I think we'll have to hope he'll call us back, and maybe he will. And I hope to try to get into this issue a little more on Sunday if people want to discuss it. I know Micah Posner, who's also an occasional listener and caller on this show of People Power, is a strong supporter of this. Scott Graham is a strong opponent. The two of them may be hard to get into the same room, but nonetheless, perhaps we can get their views side by side. Here we go. This could be Scott again, perhaps?
Oh, yes. Sorry about that.
No problem. So, was there a decision reached at the Coastal Commission?
No, it turned out that there's, you know, basically the commission itself was split. There was three of the commissioners that were definitely against the thing. There was a couple that were on the fence. And then there was two that were in favor of it. And then the new local commissioner, Mark Stone, who is the county supervisor, wanted to do this alternative that's not even part of the plan, which would slow this whole process down because they'd have to do a new environmental, or at least a supplemental environmental impact report in order to do this, you know.
Now, why should homeless people be interested in this issue? I mean, you've raised some, this as touching on homeless concerns in the past. Can you, you know, in some tenuous, perhaps Norsian way, link this to its relevance to the homeless community?
Well, in the environmental impact report, the original one, they said that if the path was built, that would necessitate it being large enough for emergency vehicles to be out there, because once you bring more people out there, there will probably be reasons, for ambulance or fire department. But more than likely, the path would be used mostly by the police and the rangers. And there's already some homeless encampments there, which would probably increase if there was a path.
So your concern is that this would increase the harassment of homeless people by the rangers and police?
Of course, yes. It's easier for the homeless to get in there, so more of them camp there, but it's also easier for the police and the rangers to get in there because they have a trail they can drive on. Then, of course, they're going to be harassed for it.
Now, did you, when you presented your case to the Coastal Commission, did you use the, I take it you didn't use the homeless-friendly argument, use the homeless-hostile argument, which
is... You're right, the homeless scare tactic.
Which is essentially, if you build this path, it'll mean that homeless by the hundreds will be able to get into the area and invade.
They'll be in there, they'll destroy the place just like they have destroyed Poganip and the Moor Creek uplands.
Moor Creek Uplands, of course, is the north county, the north part of the county's...
not county, city.
City, yes.
Well, they call it the Western.
And did you see, approving grunts from the homeless, hostile bigots in the crowd when you brought up this argument?
No, people pretty much ignored it. You know, it's like, I think it was probably not really a good argument because people didn't really care about the... because basically, like I was saying earlier before I had to take that call, was that the Coastal Commission is basically concerned with how this thing relates to the Coastal Act. And when the people from People Power and the other bicycle advocates that were there kept on saying we need this, to be able to ride back and forth, that had nothing to do with the Coastal Act. Now, people that were going up, the other environmentalists are going up there and saying, well, this path is not coastal dependent and it's not resource dependent, then that meant something to the Coastal Commission.
But we don't know what's going to happen yet. When is the soonest time they're going to make a decision on this?
Oh, well, they've put it off. They continued the item. So that means that it could be up to a year.
So,
and if, let's say the city, because the city, once the city started hearing that people wanted to either eliminate the bike path or change it drastically, they all of a sudden, the one representative of the city stood up and she said, well, the city would be okay with a continuance.
I see. So the city has no objection to waiting a year on this.
Yeah. See, right. And plus the benefit in a year, whatever stuff they were supposed to try to figure out, they haven't figured out yet. They can continue more,
Right.
So it could be up to a year. It could be less than a year. It all depends on the city staff and also the local coastal staff.
Okay, well, I will perhaps get another perspective on this on Sunday from Micah Posner. And thank you, Scott. Anything you want to add about, Dick Wilson, our city manager's retirement, or anything else?
Well, there's speculation that probably Martine Bernal will become the next city manager, and which is probably fairly likely. My concern is they're going to do the same thing they did before Leslie Cook became the city clerk, which has spent, you know, $50,000 or $70,000 hiring a headhunter to try to find somebody to become the new city manager, and then in the end hire Martine. And the city's crying that they're broke, but they're going to spend $70,000 on nothing, you know.
Well, Scott, thank you for that ringing endorsement of the city. We have, however, some commentary from our upcoming disc jockey man, Uncle Dennis. Dennis?
He was at the commission hearing also.
Yeah, this is Uncle Dennis, and I spent 5 hours plus sitting in that hearing room today. What I did not hear was that Coastal Commission make their deliberations. I had to leave to come back here and... Oops, we lost him.
Strangely enough, but go ahead. Make your...
What I didn't get to hear was the decision, and I heard that on the way over here, thanks to your
Scott
caller.
Gray. Yes. Will you be discussing this matter further in your environmental breaks on your musical tirades?
Well, certainly during the Earth First update, I'll go into this whole thing a little bit more. It's somewhat more complicated, but anyway, we will certainly try and delve into it. I'm somewhat happy that the Coastal Commission has continued this, only because it means that it wasn't a slam dunk for the city. So,
you got something against our fathers and mothers in the city, Uncle Dennis?
Well, this whole thing is kind of a shell game on the city's part. All the money they're using to develop Arana Gulch comes from transportation funds, except for about $500,000 they're going to pull in locally. But all the rest of that is Caltrans money and Regional Transportation Commission money. And as Scott said, all the Coastal Commission wants to know is this going to save the tar plant? And Micah Posner and the Green Shirts did a great job.
The Green Shirts? What kind of a comment is that about our bicycle men and women?
They did a great job of explaining how this was going to help bicycling in Santa Cruz, but that doesn't mean diddly to the commission. What the city is really trying to do, see, the city is on the hook for actually maintaining the tar plant. If the tar plant goes extinct, the city can get sued. And they don't want to get sued, so they also don't have money to maintain the tar plant. So this little shell game is, can we get RTC transportation money, get the bicycle path put in, and take a little bit of that money and put it toward preserving the tar plant? And I'm hoping the Coastal Commission doesn't buy this, because as soon as... See, the city's been waiting for this decision for a long time. Because they are liable to get sued for not maintaining a habitat for an endangered species of tar plant.
What would that involve if they wanted to maintain that habitat?
Well, they need to put cows on it. All the scientists say...
Cows in Santa
cows.
Cruz?
Yes. The tar plant... has been maintained in the far history. It was maintained by deer and elk and other browsers who came down and ate the grasses off of the prairie because a lot of grass grew there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they dug up the soil. Well, that is what it takes to keep the tar plant alive. And the only modern analog of that is cows.
Horses, perhaps?
Horses don't do as good a job.
Mm.
Horses might work. But the city's plan is to put half a dozen cattle out there.
What about homeless people grazing on the grass?
They're going to have to eat a lot of grass.
Indeed. And they usually eat a lot of shit as it is, so maybe it's only a step up.
Well, the city's going to be on the hook one way or the other for maintaining the tar plant population out there. And frankly, they've fallen on their face doing it. Their only salvation is to get this money. And they're trying to sell this bike path to the Coastal Commission. And I'm hoping the Coastal Commission doesn't buy it and that an environmental group like the Center for Biological Diversity steps in, files a lawsuit against the city of Santa Cruz. And then the city of Santa Cruz is going to have to maintain that habitat for the tar plant. And unfortunately, they don't have the money to do it. So we're going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place here in Santa Cruz.
Or Iraq and Afghanistan, as the case
Iraq and Afghanistan. Anyway, let's see. I haven't even picked out a CD to put on
I
yet.
I can play a little music while you're waiting if you want.
Okay, go ahead.
All right.
And we'll get set
anyway,
up.
Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Coming up next, of course, is Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the Dregs. 3 hours of music, commentary, and even your calls with the occasional sip of ale, which wends its way into the studio, always with a colorful name and usually a dark brown bottle, or something that's dark and brown about the whole thing. And Dennis will be talking to you more about that when he gets into it, and he will be getting into it shortly. Here's a final song for you, which I liked, and maybe you'll like it too. That wasn't really a song, was it? Let's try this. Stop smirking, Dennis, for heaven's sake. Show some respect, for God's sake.
You did flunk out of DJ school, right?
I never darkened their doors, actually.
From every corner of the world, they came from all around. When in 1851 they struck gold upon the ground, every voyage was a long one, months upon the stormy sea. Some to seek their fortune, others escaping slavery. What they found on the gold fields was rule by brutish thugs, discrimination and taxation mixed with swinging billy clubs. The gold was getting scarcer and cops were getting worse. The diggers burned their licenses and vowed to end this curse. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. The crown tried to divide them, giving preference to some. The diggers wouldn't have it. They said it's all of us or none. They built a stockade while the redcoats massed nearby, and they heard the miners shouting, "We're ready now to die." The rebel miners waited for whatever lay in store, and on one December morning in 1854, the redcoats attacked the camp. Dozens there would fall amongst these brave gold diggers who'd risen to the call. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. Over and things go their way. But when 15,000 miners rallied a month later on the day, the crown conceded everything, all of their demands. They'd won an end to license fees, the right to vote and land. So here's to Joe and Charlie, Waller and the rest. They drew the battle lines and put crown rule to the test. The diggers may have lost the battle, but they quickly won the day. And those shots fired in Victoria were heard 10,000 miles away. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun.
Some great stuff from Robert, Steve, David Rovics. But can't talk tonight. Anyway, David Rovics is in town next weekend on Saturday night. He'll be playing at a party, Anyway, out on Western Drive. And if you want to know the details of that, go to the Resource Center for Nonviolence website and check it out. Unfortunately, I really tried to get David Rovics to the Free Radio birthday party, but he can't make it. He's going to be in Florida that night. He will be coming back on the 28th, playing up in Ben Lomond somewhere, I think. So we're going to see David Rovics twice, but not at the Free Radio birthday party. I am really sad about that. And I think he's pretty sad about it, too. I think I emailed him a couple of months ago, and I think he forgot or something. I don't know. Anyway, is this your CD here? No, that's Free Radio's new CD. This is David Rovics' new CD. It's called 10,000 Miles Away. And we just got it in here the other day, and we'll probably play some more of it around the studio here and there. I am Uncle Dennis. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. We're also on the Wide Weird Web at freakradio.org. And it's time to get into From the Cream to the Dregs. Now let's start with some Shuggy Otis. Who's Shuggy Otis? This is Shuggy Otis. Oh, yeah.